My biology teacher in high school was amazing. Wally Good was his name. Everyone loved Mr. Good. He was brilliant and funny. He challenged us. He would not let me refuse to stick my hand into a huge jar of fat, wiggling earthworms and pull one out, even though it was really growthed out for days, just like I told him I would be. And every spring, he organized two weekend field trips to Bennett Springs, Missouri, where we stayed overnight in a park lodge and we went exploring in caves. Not just one, but two trips. He scheduled the second one for prom weekend so that the kids who weren't going to prom could just be out of town. I loved Mr. Good. But I hated biology class. I hated science. It was the only class I ever got a C in. And then one day, about 40 years later, it's a Sunday morning, and I'm at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, where I've been a member for over 15 years. The sanctuary's packed, and the minister asks us to turn to the person next to us and greet them. So I turn to the stranger sitting next to me on my right, who's already smiling and holding his hand out to me. "Hi," he says, "I'm Wally Good." And I do this little shriek. Seriously. It turns out Wally's been a member here like forever, even back when he was my high school teacher. Who knew? So I started babbling something like, "Oh, you were my high school biology teacher at Southwest. You were the best. Going to Bennett Springs, it was so incredible, and it was the only class I ever got a C in." And just then the music starts. The choir begins to sing. We all turn back toward the front, and I can sense that I've disturbed Mr. Good. Because several times during the service, he leans over and whispers questions to me. "Was the class boring? Did you ever ask me for extra help? How could I have made it more interesting for you?" And I don't know, it was 40 years ago. I was just passionate about the humanities, I guess, and I really wish I hadn't said that about the sea. Needless to say, we have a very long discussion in the lobby afterwards. He'll always be a teacher, and to him, I'm still worthy of teaching. This is just a story from my life to illustrate that my knowledge of the complexities of science is somewhat lacking. Still. But I believe in science. What we know about the universe, its origins, and how it works is ever-evolving, of course. We don't know what we don't know yet. So my hope is always to stay open-minded about what might be the nature of ultimate reality, letting my own experience inform me, and my own experience includes listening to other people's reflections and interpretations and challenges to my own perspectives. So my beliefs grow and change, except that so far, no experience has led me to trust what science proves is not real. So the concept of God is a pretty tough one. I feel pretty safe in saying that the traditional meaning of the word God, understood today, as understood today by most Americans, is one that is not supported by 21st century science. That's the anthropomorphic male God who's existed forever, is eternal, created the universe, created us, is all-powerful, and can intervene in human history on a whim or when requested to help you find that perfect parking spot, make sure that the good guys win, whether we're talking basketball or war, or reward your superior goodness relative to that of your neighbors by deciding exactly where the tornado will and won't touch down. I've also grown increasingly aware that a lot of people freely and happily use God language without meaning anything of the kind. And they find that word spiritually powerful. Not only Unitarian Universalists, but a lot of liberal Christians and Jews and others. And we're not aware of that other meaning so much because the public conversation assumes the traditional meaning and also doesn't challenge it, doesn't even counter it. But if you look through our UU hymn books, both of them, the gray and the teal, you'll find a lot of references to God. Unitarian Universalism is an evolving faith with a living tradition, so that every time our hymn books are revised, they reflect our current shared pluralistic theology. And you'll notice that there is nothing in either hymn book about hell or judgment or eternal salvation. But there's plenty of God language. I also guarantee you that that's not about the patriarchal, powerful sky god. And I guarantee you that God doesn't mean the same thing to everyone. But what else does it mean? Well, thinking of God as another word for nature or evolution or mystery, well, okay. But for me, that doesn't have much power. Why not just say nature or evolution or mystery? After a whole lot of theological education and spiritual work, when I read or sing or hear God, unless it's clearly a reference to the sky god, I understand it as this. The spirit of life and love and compassion and justice, that's part of each of us. And if you must understand that on a scientific basis, which admittedly, sadly, I sometimes must, think of how our human brains have evolved through the millennia with the potential for empathy, hurting when we see someone else hurting, for cooperation, putting aside our individual concerns for the common good, for creativity, imagining future possibilities that might improve how we live or how we live together. I've come to understand God as the sum of all of us acting from those parts of our humanity, as opposed to those other parts that have also evolved, the aggression, the tribalism, the selfishness, that have enabled our survival as a species, but that now endanger the entire planet. If we learn to trust and to express it, God is the part of us that's our salvation from the not God part. And that's been working for me. But now, just when I thought it was safe to go back in the hymn book, along comes a book that's getting enormous attention in my UU theological world. It's about a God that could be real, that is, not metaphorical. Real as in grounded in a modern scientific knowledge. In fact, the title is A God That Could Be Real, Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet. The author's Nancy Abrams. She's a lawyer, a Fulbright scholar with a degree in history and the philosophy of science. She co-created the program of scientific mediation, and that helps government agencies make informed policy decisions and issues where science is crucial and disputed. She's also been married for almost 40 years to Joel Primack, who is the professor of physics and astrophysics at the University of California in Santa Cruz, a graduate of Princeton and got a PhD from Stanford, and whose fields of studies are quantum field theory, cosmology, and particle astrophysics. I can almost not even say that. He's best known for his co-authorship of The Theory of Cold Dark Matter. Need it be said that I know nothing about cold dark matter or particle astrophysics. So I mention this only that when Nancy Abrams describes a God that could be real, she means scientifically real, and she apparently has some credibility in that area. As an atheist and a scientist by marriage, Abrams wasn't interested in a God that had to be believed in. If there were going to be a God in her life, that God had to be objectively real, in the way that matter and gravity and culture are real. So she tried a little experiment when she was suffering from an eating disorder, and she had decided to attend a 12-step program. So, of course, right away she came up against the requirement to turn her life over to a higher power of her understanding. But she heard that as a requirement to develop her own understanding. And one day, confronted unexpectedly with a long, beautiful, bountiful buffet line, and knowing she was going to just blow it, she tried something. She acted as if she believed in a higher power. She even spoke to it, realizing she was just speaking to some part of her own mind as though it were separate. And she says that worked. For the first time, she was just able to walk away, not even tempted. But she had no illusion that she was talking to anything outside herself. She was just imagining a loving, not-to-be-deceived witness to her thoughts. And doing that made her feel more honest and more courageous and happier. And this kept working for her. Clearly, some aspect of her consciousness was better able to control her behavior than her usual default consciousness when she conjured that up as a higher power. And she kept trying to figure it out. And finally, she settled on the realization that this was her own higher self, the one she liked to have in control. And the moment she concluded that, it stopped working for her. Because now that power was clearly under her control. And she couldn't turn her decisions over to it anymore. She knew this power couldn't be inside of her, but she also knew it couldn't be outside of her. Abrams really wanted to find an understanding of God that was real, that she wouldn't have to reject as irrational. And she wanted her God to be a source of power and comfort, but she also wanted herself to feel coherent intellectually and emotionally and spiritually. She concluded that the question, "Does God exist?" is useless and it goes nowhere. Instead, you start from what's real, what actually exists, and then you ask, "Can anything actually exist in the universe and as understood currently by science that's worthy of being called God?" And she says yes, that God, real God, does exist and does matter. And I'm starting to say, I'm getting this, because it is a lot like my own adequate enough God definition as I begin to understand what she's talking about. But hers goes broader and deeper, even providing the answer to that so what question. Why does it matter? So it all starts with the theory of emergence. Very simply put, from simple elements, some realities emerge with a higher level of complexity. And this is the important part, with a completely new identity, radically different from any of those constituent parts. That this new whole is much, much more and much different than the sum of its parts. The scientific example, I will give you a really simple one, is that no atom of your body is actually alive, but you're alive. You're a unique and conscious human being. Well, that's about as sophisticated as I can get with that, but we can easily observe in other ways in our lives, all of us, how emergence works. Let's talk about corporations. They're made up of thoughts and opinions and achievements of many persons. But in spite of what the Supreme Court tells you, corporations are not persons. They don't feel joy or pain. They have no beliefs. They have no compassion, even though each individual who works for them hopefully does. Here's another example. Large numbers of people trade goods and services for money. And that becomes a market, and that market takes on a life of its own. And that market has power over our lives. It determines prices. It affects the value of money. No one can reliably predict its outcomes. It is at a higher level of complexity than any of its participants ever fully understand. It is raised from the collective ambitions, reasons, actions, opinions of a vast number of people. And once the market has spoken, there is no appeal to a higher authority. And in this time of some sort of emerging political system, consider the media as a thing. The media shapes our society. It's the internet and the television and publications, radio, movies, all of them mutually reinforcing their impact. The media, it manipulates our politics. It influences what we believe, what we think we know. It shapes our emotions and our desires. It excites us. It scares us. tells us how to raise our kids and how to spend our money. But what is it? There's no there. It's not human. But it emerges from humans and human activity. And so, says Abrams, God has emerged from humans, from our highest aspirations. Almost everything that matters to our lives today, so cooking and language, agriculture, economics, science, art, education, religion, every one of those is an abstraction. Every one of those is very real, and they all arose over time from the collective aspirations of our ancestors. Aspirations, they are different from mere desires, like for food and security and sex. Beyond our survival needs, we humans strive for something better. Those are our aspirations, to feel better, to act more creatively, to be safer, to avoid doing harm. This God is endlessly emerging from the enormous complexity of humanity's aspirations interacting across time. And this God is the guiding force of science and behind our desire for beauty and for love. And it has power in our lives when we try to imagine our participation in the universe and wondering what this emerging God might tell us if it could speak. It would speak for all humanity, not for your favorite political party or for your country. This new reality that emerges from humans but takes on a life of its own doesn't always deserve to be called God. If we don't individually and collectively listen to this higher power to make sure it's really our best aspirations and not our survival fears that are guiding us, what can emerge are, I would call it, demonic forces, which is also a new and different entity, uncontrollable and possibly even unintended by any of its individual human parts. There's a scene from the movie Cabaret, and I know some of you have seen it, that chillingly demonstrates this. It takes place in pre-World War II Nazi Germany. There's a character named Brian, who's a writer, and his decadent aristocrat friend named Max. They're visiting a Berlin beer garden that's full of people eating and drinking beer and talking. And as Max and Brian talk, they're interrupted by a boy singing a patriotic song with touching, inspirational words. The sun on the meadow is summery warm. The stag in the forest runs free, but gather together to greet the storm. Tomorrow belongs to me. And that song, beginning with a close-up of this young boy's angelic face, only gradually moving the camera down to reveal he's dressed in the uniform of the Hitler Youth. You see the swastika on his arm. The boy's singing steadily grows more and more strident. The babe in his cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon there's a whisper, "Arise, arise, tomorrow belongs to me." And the other Germans at the beer garden start paying attention, and they join in. As more and more voices join in, the song goes from being hopeful and optimistic to being ominous and threatening. "Oh, fatherland, fatherland, show us the sign. Your children are waiting to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs to me." And the boy puts on his Hitler Youth cap and sings the ending with his arm in the Sieg Heil salute. Everyone is on their feet, singing, except for one old man who declines to join in, instead watches with a heavy sadness. And Max and Brian get up, get in their car, and leave, saying to an official, "You still think you can control them?" No, it's its own thing now. It's out of control. Spirituality, according to Abrams, is the experience of connection with what you know to be real. When we're connected to our ancestors, even if we don't always feel what that means, to practice esteem for our ancestors, even long, long ago and far away, gives us a sense of continuity. And it also gives us some appreciation of what it took to get us here. So each of us is a miracle. The odds were infinitesimal beyond our wildest imaginations that each one of us is alive right now. And if we don't really live in that awareness with every breath we take, then we can't understand how what we do right now, every minute, changes everything, changes the future of the entire planet, helps to create God or demons. We're already, we are ancestors already, and the people of the future that we serve, they're real. They're just not here yet, but they're real. And our connection to the future is what gives our lives meaning. And if somehow that connection to the future were broken, life would lose its purpose. It would feel like it lost its purpose. There's another movie scene that shows this also chillingly, which is the final scene from the film Melancholia. The story is about a family facing the fact that a meteor is heading toward Earth, dead on track to destroy the world. And you'd think that this movie would be just over-the-top melodramatic, that the characters play up the terror of the situation with loud racing background music and gut-wrenching visual and sound effects. But no. No, the filming and the acting are lovely, gentle, understated. And in that last scene, the two young women and the little boy, characters that we've come to know, gather on the horizon of their backyard to face the inevitable together. And there are no words, there's no music, no sound. They sit together in a small shelter of branches that they've constructed, one silently watching the sky, one quietly sobbing, the child sitting with his eyes closed as the beautiful, ethereal-looking meteor looms quietly, ever larger in the background until it fills the screen and everything goes silent in a flash of white flame. And that's it. That's the end. It's the ultimate end. No big dramatic deal. But after I watched this over the week, I found myself feeling almost a physical sense of despair whenever I flash back to that ending, because it's about the utter annihilation of life as we know it. And putting myself in that movie, I felt there's no possibility that I will ever live on in people's memory, or that anything I ever did would ever count for anything again. Life's meaning would be gone. It's that connection to the future that gives life its meaning. We who are alive right now are connected to our ancestors mostly with gratitude. We are ancestors, and we can only hope that our descendants will find us worthy of gratitude. We're co-creators of this God in every action that we take. When we vote or fail to vote, when we make decisions for ourselves or our families, when we choose what's best right now for this congregation, for this larger community, and that's the connection with an ever-emerging God that's real. This, then, has to be the prayer that's on our lips every waking moment. Dear God, what is your will? Help us bring it into being. May it be so.